LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat. The first part of the show is free. To listen to part two, visit legalize-freedom.com and scroll down the homepage to choose your membership. My guest today is Steve Taylor, who joins us to discuss his book, Across the Universe, The Magic and Mystery of the Beatles' Creativity. What made the Beatles so extraordinary? How did these four young musicians come together at exactly the right moment? And how did everything fall into place so perfectly that they became the most innovative and successful band that the world has ever seen, and a cultural phenomenon that still shapes the world today? Was it simply a series of lucky coincidences, or were there larger reasons for their success? Taylor, a renowned scholar of psychology and spirituality and former professional musician, retells the story of the Beatles through the lens of their creativity and explains the secrets of their genius. He explores the synchronicities and synergy that generated their success and the flow state they cultivated as a group, their relentless self-development, and their spontaneous and prolific creativity. He shows how their transpersonal creativity elevated them above their peers and how they opened their minds to connect to the spirit of the 1960s, becoming transmitters of a creative energy that transcended themselves. Hello and welcome, Steve, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hi, Greg. Great to talk with you again.
Yeah, it's been a while. You're one of my early guests, actually, back in the day. I think you were on maybe 2012, 2013, something like that, and a few times since.
Oh, wow.
I think the last time we spoke was around your Time Slip book. In any event, listeners will find links to all the previous talks we've done on the website page for this one. And today we're talking about your latest book, which is coming out in 2 or 3 weeks from now, early September 2026 as we speak. Mm-hmm. And the book is entitled Across the Universe, The Magic and Mystery of the Beatles' Creativity. Before we jump into that, if you could just give listeners a little potted bio, just something about yourself, and then how you came to write this book. Obviously, you're a Beatles fan, but there's a difference between being a fan and writing a book about a band, never mind a book coming at it from the particular very specific angle that you have.
I guess my main role is as a spiritual psychologist or a transpersonal psychologist. So I have a role at my university as a researcher and a psychologist and lecturer in the field of, well, I guess the best way to describe transpersonal psychology is it investigates the overlap between spirituality and psychology. So my main interest is in spiritual experiences of spiritual transformation. And in recent years, I've got a background in music, like you. You used to play in bands, didn't you, back in the day?
Yeah, I was playing in bands when I was a teenager and in school and stuff, but I was professional for 3 years in the mid-90s.
Yeah, well, me too, actually. I was professional. The professional is a bit of a misleading word, perhaps, and I never really made much money. I was sort of living on the threshold of starvation a lot of the time. Mm. But I did attempt to make a living from playing music for about 4 years. So, yeah, I've always been a part of me has always been a musician, and I've always really had a deep appreciation for music. So in recent years, I've started to investigate the transpersonal or spiritual aspects of music and creativity in general. And that brought me to the Beatles, really, because, you know, there's no more band which is, you know, more transpersonal or even spiritual than the Beatles in terms of the amazing music they produced, and also in terms of the effect they had to people at the time, and also, you know, the effects which reverberate into the contemporary world too.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the fact that, you know, you made your best fist of earning a living from music for a few years. I did actually manage to earn a decent living, but again, only for a very short time. But I also bring to the table, as some of my listeners might already know, being a music journalist for over 25 years, that's what's taken up most of my adult life. And obviously, you've got this, you know, intense interest in music as well. So I think we've got a lot in common in these areas. because we, I don't know if you actually wrote original material when you were with your band or bands, but I did. So you learn something about, what it takes to write a song and how you describe in the book. You know, it's like perhaps it was Paul McCartney and John Lennon describing it as essentially easy in their experience, how they found it to be. But you also find what the challenges are and how people respond to something that you might have, be a labor of love for you, and for someone else it might just, hit them like a cold fish, and they're not really feeling it. So you do sort of put, even if you're, we'll get on to this, but even if you're kind of channeling something through yourself into your music, you or me or anyone else, or the Beatles, you're giving a lot of yourself. And I can't remember who the quote was from, but it was something along the lines of, you write a song, once you release it, whether you just, play it live or put it out on a record, it's kind of not yours anymore, because it belongs to the rest of the world in some way. So your child has kind of flown the coop, as it were. And I remember reading Bono, U2 lead singer, his early autobiography, and he was talking about lyrics. And I'd always found a lot of his lyrics, especially in the first four U2 albums, really spoke to me in a way. But then reading his book about the meaning of some of them, I thought, that's not what I got at all. But then his kind of approach was like, it means different things to different people, and that's one of the art, the art of songwriting, in a way that if it can speak to to individuals in a very personal level, then that's kind of a measure of success in a way, isn't it? And so I think the Beatles encapsulated all of that.
That's right. I mean, the interesting thing about the early Beatles, I mean, the thing about the Beatles is they were so many different bands. They were like at least five different bands within the same band, because every year they seem to change and be effectively a different band. So the Beatles of 1966 had very little to do with the Beatles of 1963, and the Beatles of 1967, had very little to do with the Beatles of 1966, because they evolved so quickly. But in the early Beatles songs, the lyrics are very simple. The lyrics, they were often quite meaningless about, boy and girl stuff, about love, relationships. But that was quite incidental, really, because the most important aspect was the energy of the songs. The early Beatles songs conveyed or transmitted this amazing sort of kinetic energy, this amazing excitement. And I think the Beatles were channels of that. They weren't really. I don't think they were ever really conscious, deliberate artists. They were very skilled, obviously, but the essence of their inspiration flowed through them involuntarily, and they were kind of, channels of this transcendent, transpersonal inspiration. And I think that's why they were so influential, and that's why even now their music is so powerful. It's and so fresh, because it came from, a place beyond them as individuals.
Yeah, which is exactly the word transpersonal that you were using describing your work in psychology. But if there's one kind of phrase that sums up the Beatles' kind of situation, the milieu that they were operating in, and the characters that they were, and that the sort of the classic lineup, as it were, Ringo Starr wasn't originally the drummer in the Beatles. There was Pete Best and others, and they kind of had to carve out roles for themselves, because you mentioned that Paul and John and George were basically all guitarists, so they had to kind of sort of a bit of a jockeying for position, see who's going to do what. We do need a bass player, as it were. But I guess the phrase is, what are the chances? Just this series of unlikely coincidences, stroke synchronicities, that came to, allowed them to form in the first place, particularly at a time when there just weren't, there weren't the number of musicians there are today playing in any sort of popular, genre. It's just so much larger. Recording technology is so easy now to make a world-class sounding album. Musical instruments are relatively cheap, places to perform, although they're under a lot of pressure, live venues, and they have been closing down. But basically, the Beatles emerged at a time when there was really was so little of the infrastructure that upcoming musicians now take for granted.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there were so many kind of magical aspects to the Beatles. One of the most magical aspects was the fact that it all came together so easily and so naturally. I mean, maybe the most amazing synchronicity of all is the fact that the two greatest songwriters, possibly the two greatest songwriters of the 20th century, Lennon and Paul McCartney, they lived 1 mile away from each other, you know, on either side of the golf course in Liverpool. And they were basically the same age. I think John Lennon was 18 months, 16 months older than Paul. That's just an amazing synchronicity that, you know, the two of them happened to be so close together at the same time. And then, yeah, as you say, when they got together in 1958, I mean, to play music was one thing, but also to be songwriters, nobody wrote songs at that time. So there's a story that John said to Paul, "What are your hobbies?" This is when they met when they were 15 and 16. And John said, "Oh, sorry." Paul said, "Well, I write songs." And John said, "Well, I do too." And they were amazed because nobody else wrote songs. Even in pop music back then, very, very few people wrote their own songs. The Beatles really admired Buddy Holly because he was one of the few people to write his own songs. So, I mean, that was an amazing thing too, that two songwriters and singers, you know, had the same kind of ambition and came together. And they were also, John and Paul were so complementary. They blended so well. Even their voices had a perfect blend together. Everything about them was perfectly matched. And George came in onto the scene as well. He was Paul's friend from school, and he was a lead guitar. They were looking for a lead guitarist, and Paul knew George. They used to jam together on the bus on the way home from school. And so, yeah, I mean, later on, there were so many other perfect aspects too. Like they got the perfect manager, Brian Epstein, the perfect producer, and there were just, like I say, so many different elements of of synchronicity that enabled them to become so successful.
Yeah, it was common in the early days with it, you know, with Elvis, and as rock and roll and pop started to, you know, emerge and evolve in the 60s, for there to be kind of songwriters who were not really in the spotlight at all. They wrote songs for other people, as you say, and that's what made the Beatles stand out amongst many things. And I mean, certainly when I was getting into music in the 1980s, you know, mostly hard rock and heavy metal, and I started to learn about these people like Desmond Child, and I think it was Brian Halligan, and these people who people are going, who are these people? But just the number of like hit songs that they wrote for rock bands, you know, because that was their real craft. And it was kind of like, if you've got a big arena kind of rock sound, you Desmond Child is a get him to write a single for you, and it's going to be a hit sort of thing. Even Brian Adams wrote songs for many other people, and then you've got Jim Steinman, of course, who wrote all of Meatloaf's hits, and he wrote for many other people, including Bonnie Tyler and even the Sisters of Mercy. You know, so
Of course,
these things that don't get talked about very much. So again, that was such a major thing at the time for not just one of them. It would have been one, wouldn't it, Steve? It would have been amazing if you had a Paul or a John in that band writing 90% of the songs, but you had these two guys who could easily have carried bands on their own. You could easily have had a band with just Paul writing the songs and just John, and each of those bands would have been very successful, no doubt.
That's right. Yeah, and in the so late 50s, early 60s, the division between songwriters and singers was really, you know, really extreme, especially in America. In America, you had all the Brill Building singers like Goffin King and I can't think of any others right now, or Lieber and Stoller and people like that. So, I mean, they were professional songwriters, and the singer, they just passed on their songs to a whole legion of different singers. So it was quite amazing, really, when John and Paul decided that they were going to sing their own songs. And when they got a record deal, and you probably know this, I think this is quite well in the story, that George Martin originally wanted them to sing one of the songs of a professional songwriter, a guy called Mitch Murray, called How a song called How Do You Do It? But Paul and John said, "No, we don't want to do that. We don't want to sing other people's songs. You know, we think our songs are better than other people's songs." So they insisted on singing their own song, and of course that was the, you know, that their confidence was justified. But it was quite revolutionary at the time. You know, there were so many other aspects of the Beatles. The fact that the Beatles had three singers, because of course George sang as well, and they kind of interchanged as lead singers. That was quite revolutionary at the time too. Before then, it was always a leader and a band like Cliff Richard and the Shadows. And there was always this division between the singer and the band. But the Beatles were a unity. That was an amazing thing about them, that they were a band rather than a collection of individuals.
Yeah, I always thought later on, 'cause I should say due diligence or housekeeping, whatever you want to call it. I've never been a Beatles fan. I've heard many of their songs, but I've never actually sat down with an album, whatever from whatever period, and sat through the whole thing and tried to appreciate it. But I don't think that takes away anything from my ability to appreciate what they were, what they had, and what they did, if you see what I mean. Because you don't have to like particular musicians or songwriters or whatever to appreciate their skill. And that's not to say I sort of don't like the Beatles. It's not a strong case of that. It's just that for me, it was a bit like when I started to get into music, even the music of the 70s, even a band like Led Zeppelin for years, I just neglected because I thought this over, it's done. There's nothing for me there. And then when I eventually backtracked, I realized that Led Zeppelin were one of the best bands of all time ever in any genre, and the Beatles certainly fit that category. And I also thought that, again, looking back, that when you had bands like the Bee Gees and ABBA, that they very much were facilitated by the Beatles in the sense that what the Beatles did allowed these groups to come along, multi-talented, multi-instrumentalists, multiple singers in the band writing their own songs. So the Beatles were really trailblazers there.
That's right. I mean, there was really nothing before the Beatles, especially in the UK, because rock music was really an American phenomenon. And in Britain, there were a lot of skiffle bands back then, which skiffle was kind of like a derivation of rock and roll, a British derivation of rock and roll, based on three chords and based on sort of really cheap instruments. People used to use a washboard, I think it was, as a bass because nobody could afford proper instruments. And so the Beatles were totally revolutionary. They definitely set the mold for generations of bands that came after them. And of course, they were also the first British band to have any success in America. Before then, it was completely unheard of for any British acts to have success abroad. And in fact, the first Beatles records, even though they sold millions in the UK, they weren't released in America because the American record companies couldn't conceive of the idea that a British band could be successful in America. So they just wouldn't release the records. But then there was this, this is slightly tangential, but this is one of the amazing synchronicities about that enabled the Beatles' success. That in late 1963, Ed Sullivan, who had the most popular talk show in America, he happened to be in London Airport, as it was called then, and the Beatles happened to be returning from a tour of Scandinavia on the same evening that he was in the airport. And there was this massive commotion at the airport, that thousands of screaming girls. And Ed Sullivan said, What the hell is going on? And somebody said, Oh, the Beatles are coming back from a tour. And he said, Who the hell are the Beatles? But decided, they were causing so much commotion, decided to book them on his show in America, even though they were completely unknown in America. And of course, that was the biggest talk show in America, the biggest TV show. And once they were booked on the show, then the record company decided to release the records finally. So there was this flood of Beatles records coming onto the market. And they were picked up by the radio stations. And suddenly, by the time they appeared on the show a few weeks later, they were the biggest band in America. And 75 million people, American people, sat down to watch them on the show.
Beatles and the Ed Sullivan Show is just one of the pivotal moments on the rock and pop timeline, isn't it, really, in terms of
It is, yes.
development
So
and
many American artists talk about seeing the Beatles on the show and totally changed their worldview and gave them the ambition to be musicians themselves, like Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel said that, Tom Petty, so many different people.
Yeah, now we've mentioned synchronicity here a few times. What that young Carl Jung, psychologist, amongst other things, who coined the term, he also used the word, the phrase meaningful coincidence, as something that more people would understand. So what he was thinking of about synchronicity and how important that was. We've talked about group dynamics here, which translates across into something called group flow, which is something that we can talk about. And this was something that was incredibly important in the Beatles situation. It also reminds me of Colin Wilson's idea of kind of Faculty X, when everything just seems to inexplicably work, everything you touch just turns to gold and it seems effortless. And that's when you know that you're on the right path, as it were. And we spoke about, I mean, channeling really is what was going on here to some extent. And that doesn't take away anything from the skill of, in this case, the Beatles as songwriters and musicians, but it just reinforces a wider idea. It just speaks to a wider idea about creativity and how things come into being in the world. And one of the earliest stories I heard along these lines was, going back to Led Zeppelin again, was Robert Plant and Jimmy Page talking about Stairway to Heaven, their immortal anthem. And they felt they were just, they received this. It was transmitted and they were receivers and it all just happened. It took so little time to put together. And this seems to be the case with so many of the Beatles' best known songs as well. So, but just so happens that Led Zeppelin was the first time I heard that spoken about.
That's right. I think this is the most essential thing about the Beatles and the key to their creativity. One thing about the Beatles is that they were amazingly prolific. A lot of people don't realize that they only recorded for less than 7 years, but they recorded about 220 songs, most of them, about 190 of them, self-written. So that's like a, you know, that works out as like over 30 songs a year. To write and record so many songs is, you know, is incredible, incredibly rapid. And when John and Paul talked about writing their songs, they often described it as kind of involuntary. It was incredibly rapid. John and Paul would get together for 3 or 4 hours in the afternoons. This is when they started in Liverpool, but also when later on when they were in hotel rooms or whatever, when they were on tour. And they would say that every single time they'd sit together for 3 hours and they'd come out with a finished song every single time. There was never one afternoon when it didn't work. And then, but that was the start of the process. But then they would book the studio and the other two, George and Ringo, would never hear the songs until they arrived at the studio. So they'd go down to Abbey Road and John and Paul would play the new song to Ringo and George. And Paul said that it would take maybe an hour for George and Ringo to work out their parts. Ringo would tap away on his knee. George would work out the chords and work out a little solo. And within an hour, the song would be ready to record. They'd work out harmonies quickly. So then they'd go in the studio. And usually they would book studio sessions for 3 hours, maybe two sessions, adding up to 5 or 6 hours in one day with a break in between. And they would record two or three new songs in one day. So that means that they, you know, from the creation of a song to the finished mix of a song, it would just be maybe 5 or 6 hours in total, which is incredibly rapid. And when you hear these songs now, they sound fantastic. They don't sound rushed. They sound perfectly arranged. You know, that the vocals are quite complex, backing vocals. George's guitar solos are quite intricate and complex. Paul's bass lines are very, you know, very interesting and well developed. So you would never have guessed that these songs came from just 5 hours of creativity. But this could only work really because the Beatles had this group mind. They weren't really individuals. They were interconnected minds that created a larger group mind. And a lot of their contemporaries were really aware of this. There's a good quote from Roger McGuinn, who was in the Byrds, one of the Beatles' American contemporaries. And he said that in about 1965, they met the Beatles when the Beatles were on tour in America, and they were chatting to George. And Roger McGuinn asked George, "Do you believe in God, George?" And George said, "Oh, we haven't decided yet." So he said, and George, Roger McGuinn was really struck by it was the we, you know, we haven't decided. And there was another interview the same year, I think, when John Lennon was asked by an Australian TV interviewer, "Do you believe in God, John?" And John said, "We've decided that we're agnostics." So it was all, you know, as if they didn't have an individual mind. And that came from their shared background, for their from their months of, you know, living together in terrible conditions in Hamburg and playing for 8 hours every day. They kind of fused together and became a group mind.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And there wasn't there a another maybe slightly disparaging quote, but kind of it's, I'd say with some affection as well. Wasn't it Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones that referred to the Beatles as a four-headed monster?
That's right. I think it was Mick Jagger, actually, but
Oh, okay,
that's
yeah,
right.
Mick Jagger, yeah.
Yeah, and Eric Clapton said the same. He said that there was something really peculiar about the Beatles because they seem to think together. They seem to, you know, even their movements seem to be interconnected and synchronized. He said they were like a really tight family unit who shared the same mind.
Yeah, well, this a couple of points springing from that, really. One is the shared dream that Paul and John had early on of, you know, digging for, well, ultimately for treasure, and that, you know, to both have the same dream is kind of uncanny. But in the shows that I've done talking about dreams and related things, I've come to conclude, and through my own experience as well, that dreams in a way are kind of a shared space. That is to say, that it's not necessarily just your space. I have I remember one memorable occasion meeting some quote unquote meeting someone I hadn't seen for years in a dream and saying to them, "What are you doing here?" And they said, "Oh, I have dreams too." It's kind of like, we're in the dream space now and it's not just all yours. So there's that interesting idea about, the collective unconscious again, going back to Jung, but then also creative individualism, the kind of the man as the creative as kind of an island. We can all think of individuals, really strong creative personalities who've dominated bands and sometimes are the only remaining member, and it's really their thing with some hired hands floating around. But the Beatles demonstrate to me the power of what Napoleon Hill, the famous writer on New Thought, called in his book Think and Grow Rich, the power of the mastermind. That's the power of bringing minds together to work on a project, always being superior to the kind of the rugged individual who's going to go it alone. He stresses this is important, and I think in the Beatles experience kind of emphasizes that.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, that was the reason. When you do come together into a group mind, everything happens really quickly and naturally. Your creativity becomes so easy, effortless, and spontaneous. This often happens in other bands. I think I mentioned in the book Black Sabbath and Joy Division, that they would find that they would just write songs. They would just, and within an hour, a new song would be spontaneously created. They would just need to get together in the same space, and songs would seem to naturally arise. And when you're an individual, you can it's more of a struggle. You're sort of pitting your wits against the entire universe and trying to struggle to get something out. I mean, sometimes if you're in a state of flow, individual creativity can be quite quick too, but it's much easier when it happens within a group. And it applies to a lot of different situations. It applies to sport too. When you get a team which is interconnected and there's a strong synergy, they're very mentally attuned to each other, then the whole team takes on a greater identity and it shifts to a higher level of ability. So even though the individuals within the team may not be so talented or gifted, they can actually, together, they can take on much more seemingly much more gifted teams and occasionally, achieve amazing feats. So yeah, that was a great thing about the Beatles. They were, as you say, it was like a shared space of consciousness. And I think the dream you mentioned is one of the best illustrations of that. I can just explain it in a bit more detail for listeners. But the dream was that Paul McCartney had this recurring dream where he would be digging in his garden, with his fingers, just digging through the dirt in the garden, and he would keep finding tin cans and bits of scrap metal. But then he met John Lennon for the first time. They decided to form a band, and a few weeks later, he had the same dream, but this time he was digging in his garden and he found gold coins. He kept finding one gold coin after the next, and he went to see John Lennon and said, "Wow, I had this amazing dream last night. I was digging in my garden and found these gold coins." And John said, "Wow, that's amazing. I had the same dream." So obviously that dream, it signified that their minds were interconnected, but it also symbolized that, they were going to achieve great success together. The complementarity of their personalities, was the basis of great, of, amazing achievements to come.
Now, we know that, all things must come to an end, and the Beatles, split up, sort of disintegrated to some extent. Doesn't take away from their legacy, but it was never going to last forever, no matter what. But that unusual thing that we've come back to again and again, this, you said complementarity, and if I've even said that correctly, and just that shared consciousness and that unified drive. And if you look at some of the other, biggest successful acts, in rock and pop. You mentioned, Black Sabbath. They were kind of like a touchstone band for me, and how much substance abuse and interpersonal conflict played a role to some extent in the creativity. And then another band like Pink Floyd, huge international success, but again, internal tensions and certainly in the early stages of the band, that the mental illness of Syd Barrett, which that kind of had to happen, as it were. So the Beatles, and it's not as simple as this, but this particularly unified front that we've mentioned a few times, and that flow, and it seems to have been unparalleled, necessarily unparalleled before, but certainly since. I mean, can you think of another group that was had, you know, big international success. It could be in terms of that group flow and that organized mind. It's operated on anything like that basis.
Well, maybe U2 is a good example.
Yeah, because you still got the original lineup, haven't you? That's important.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really imagine U2 without any of the individual members, and they were all school friends. I mean, one of the things about a group flow or the group mind, it has to be individuals from the same kind of background who have shared challenges together.
That concludes part one of the show. To listen to part two, visit legalize-freedom.com and scroll down the homepage to choose your membership.
LegalizeFreedom.com